Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
My name is Ryan, and you are listening to The Vegan Report. In light of recent news that the Trump administration is scaling back animal experimentation across various levels of government, such as the National Institute of Health, the Environmental Protection Agency, and even the military, it is time to put to rest this idea that conservatives do not care about animals or have no place in the animal protection movement. I believe that anyone willing to advance this cause and put an end to the bloody business of animal exploitation, indiscriminately of religion, culture, race, ethnicity, or something as trivial as political inclinations, should be welcomed and supported by this movement. To discuss this topic and more, we are lucky to have Liam Gray, someone who is immersed in the world of politics. He is the founder of the Wilberforce Institute, which is a public policy think tank dedicated to advancing the recognition of the inherent value and dignity of life, a market free from corrupt and coercive government intrusion, and intellectually diverse policies that benefit human and animal interests. Visit the link in the episode notes to learn more about their great work and how to support them. Okay, so to kick off this conversation, I want you to comment on what I think to be one of the biggest scandals of the animal rights movement, which is the fact that the biggest progress that we have seen in the animal, pro-animal cause came from a conservative government. And I'm talking about the ban on animal testing. So the National Institute of Health recently announced an initiative to phase out animal testing. So they will now prioritize human-based research methods, such as, you know, data science, artificial intelligence, and tests on lab-grown organ-like structures called organoids. I don't know if you ever heard of that term before. The EPA has the ambition of completely banning animal testing. And following this is the Navy, the U.S. Navy, that has decided to end all research testing on cats and dogs. Now, it is a scandal because if you ask your average animal rights activists what is their opinion of conservatives and of the Trump administration or any right-leaning person, they will have a very hostile reaction, and they believe, and I'm talking from, you know, experience of conversations with them, that there is no progress to be, no accomplishment from, you know, collaborating with conservatives. And obviously, this is wrong. So, okay, can you explain what is happening here? How come, you know, one of the, if not the biggest progress for the animal cause in recent memory came from a conservative government, from the Trump administration, and without, you know, your the traditional animal rights, you know, ways of putting pressure. And, you know, this was not the result of a nationwide campaign from PETA or of protests organized by, name your favorite animal rights organization. So what is happening, Ian?
Sure. So, and I think you're right. The impact this is having and the trajectory it's on. I mean, I don't think it's overly optimistic to say that, the end of animal experimentation writ large could be right on the horizon now. Obviously, there's still a lot more to go, but the progress has been incredible. I think it's really important when we look at what happened here to look at the work of White Coat Waste, which is an organization. They're nonpartisan, but they've worked extensively with conservatives and libertarians, especially Republicans in Congress. A lot of the ones that I think much of the animal rights movement would be, the least willing or least interested or to work with, or they would at least think of them as, maybe people that they wouldn't be worth their time to reach out to, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who went after Fauci on the NIH's Beagle experiments in front of Congress, or Nancy Mace, who's worked on a ton of these issues with White Coat Waste. What White Coat did White Coat is entirely focused on government funded animal experimentation. That is the entire scope of what they work on, and they talk about this not only from the cruelty aspect, which they never shy away from talking about the cruelty in these experiments, but they also talk about the waste. That the taxpayer waste, the excessive spending that we're doing on these programs, the absurdity of most of these experiments. My inclination, this is a sort of anecdotal thing, but I don't necessarily have some stats behind this, but I think what you have a lot of with a lot of these kinds of experimentation programs is, if you've worked in any kind of especially government organization, but also big corporations do the same thing, and you're coming to the end of the fiscal quarter and you realize that you're not going to get the budget you got last year unless you spend some more money. So they go, and then that's how, when I was in the Army, we ended up spending, excessive amounts of money on things like staplers just to make sure that we get the same money we did last year. Right. I think you have the same thing going on with these experiments in a lot of times where they have these research projects that, routinely make Senator Rand Paul's Festivus report, where it just highlights, absurd spending that the government's doing every year. A lion's share of that comes from White Coat research, and it's always these ridiculous experiments. Like the left tried to say this one wasn't real, but it's been proven real. The transgender mice experiments, where they were doing transgender operations on mice. I mean, it's not only is it excessively cruel, it's ridiculous. Why are we doing this? So I think that if you take that success and you look at what they've done there and you extrapolate that to the other areas where animals are being harmed, especially at the hands of the government or with our tax dollars, the most obvious of those being factory farming, I think it gives you a good roadmap on how we can actually make some progress here. And that's what, with the Wilberforce Institute, what we're trying to do.
I want to get back to this perception of conservatives as being the enemy. And I want to give a concrete example of that. So after the election, I made an episode called Make Animal Rights Bipartisan Again. And I shared that on the vegan subreddit. And I got demolished. So let me read some of the comments I got from that podcast. We can't get the conservatives to care about starving humans, so I don't know why they'd care about non-humans. Conservatives don't give a shit about animal rights. Conservatives don't give a shit about human rights. Then there was someone who commented, vegan conservatives here. And someone responded, trying to phrase this in a way that isn't a loaded question, but do you feel like there's any inconsistencies between veganism and any of your political views? And then following that, you mean you're a plant-based conservative? Explain yourself. I want to see fewer chickens and more Mexican children in cages. And I could go on and on and on. Why is there this antagonism towards conservatives?
Yeah, I think it has to do with the general sort of tribalism and teams thing that we've got, and especially in the States. I don't know what it looks like elsewhere in the world exactly, but because we have this two-party system, and it's very entrenched in these two teams. Anything that gets coded as one side or the other gets bashed if you have any kind of crossover, which is obviously a really unproductive thing for your normal non-deep state citizen, right? But it's interesting because it's something, when you look at depending on what stats you want to use. I think in that episode you're talking about, I believe you referenced the Fondalytics study. But there's a number of these where, I mean, any study you point to is going to show most people, sincerely and have sincere, heartfelt care for animals. Most people love animals. Most people hate factory farming. I would argue, I don't think there's anybody out there really that isn't paid to like factory farming that actually likes factory farming, But even though we have that, it's still, even though those are the general perceptions everyone has, the factory farming is growing every single year, and I think a lot of that has to do with exactly what you're talking about here, where it's, we're so entrenched and it keeps conservatives away from the animal issue to have that kind of response when they try to go into animal issues. Right. And it's a reciprocal thing. There's, it's on, both ends of it, but yeah, I think it's certainly hurting the progress and what we can actually hope to attain for animals when you have this artificial political divide that doesn't really actually make any sense when it comes down to it. What does my view? What are my views on tax policy really have to do with my views on animals, right? And also that sort of those kinds of pejorative understanding of what your opposition believes, like, because I voted for Trump doesn't mean I want to see Hispanic kids in cages or whatever that one quote was, that kind of thing. It's like that's not actually what I voted for any more than it was Biden that went to the Supreme Court with alongside Smithfield and Vilsack, his big dairy lobbyist head of the USDA, and tried to push the EATS Act through the Supreme Court, and it was Trump's appointees that ruled against it, right? So that doesn't mean I'm going to I'm not now going to say every single Democrat out there, or everyone who voted for Biden is a proponent of factory farming, or is anti Prop 12, or is anti or wants to federalize wants to stop Prop 12 from a federal level. That's obviously not that would be a leap for me to say that, right? But I don't think people are necessarily accepting that kind of nuance.
Let me add a layer of complication to this whole story. I learned from preparing for this conversation that during the first Trump administration, they wanted to ban up to 30% of animal experimentations with the EPA. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to accomplish that goal for the year 2025. But when the Biden administration came into power, they stopped that. Now, there is also the fact that during the electoral campaign, when Tim Walz, I think the VP with Kamala, was presented as a candidate, the first promotional video that announced his name and his presence on the political scene, we saw him in that video in a dairy farm, and he worked hard to build that character of, hey, I'm the hunting guy, I'm the guy who cares about dairy farmers, and this felt like like the candidate you would not want to vote for as a vegan or someone who cares about animals.
Right.
So why do most vegans and animal rights activists think of the liberal platform and liberal party as the most, you know, pro-animal party when there is evidence that they don't care about animals.
Yeah, and that's one I can't answer exactly why they would think it, right? But you're right. And that whole campaign, it makes me think of the Tim Walz is the big. I think that there was something like a overcorrection on this perception of like the masculinity idea, right? There's like this idea that they're voting for Trump because I don't know, because they think he can beat him in an arm wrestling match or something, but it's a very silly idea to begin with. But I think you can see that elsewhere where there's that. I haven't followed this guy at all. I really honestly don't know too much about him, but the Hassan Piker, who they're kind of marketing as like the Joe Rogan of the left, right? Which is funny in and of itself, because that's a guy, you can make a case that the Joe Rogan of the left is Joe Rogan, but that's a whole other thing. But it's funny, you know, my understanding is this guy is a big, he's always eating chickens. Like it's this thing for him where he's like, you know, and I guess it's kind of pitched as like this manly, you know, masculine kind of thing. But when you compare that to the person they're talking about, Joe Rogan, Joe Rogan's a meat eater for sure. And he's a hunter, but he also, he's talked extensively on his show about how horrible factory farming is, how he's only going to eat from animals that he kills himself. And like, hey, he won't eat the factory farm meat because of the cruelty. And, you know, is that from a vegan perspective ideal? No, but it's, you know, directionally exactly where, you know, way better than this other guy who's eating mass produced chicken every day and advertising it and making it into this manly thing. And that's coming from the left. So it's interesting. I don't know where that perception, where it comes from. You know, the namesake of our organization, William Wilberforce, was a Christian conservative reformer who, you know, helped, was largely credited with ending the slave trade in England, but he also founded the RSPCA. It was the first animal welfare organization in the world, and that came from, you know, a conservative. So it's not like there's no history of this. I mean, you've talked about Matthew Scully in other episodes, and Matthew Scully is for any listeners who haven't caught that, he's a presidential speechwriter, Republican speechwriter, who wrote a book called Dominion, which is really, I think has brought a lot of conservatives, a lot of the conservatives who stopped eating animals, I think, point to that book. But the interesting thing about that book is it's not a conservative case for not eating animals. It's a human case for not eating animals. You know, we're coming to these things from the same reasons. We have the same concerns for animals. I think that the disparity is almost I think more than anything else, it kind of goes back to the sort of tribal thing and the teams thing that we have going on. If that makes sense, there's a perception where if you're of the right, you're not supposed to be a part of these movements of the animal movement, and the animal movement, you know, does everything they can to fulfill that and kind of make it seem like unfriendly territory. You know, as you pointed out with those comments and things like that.
Yes, definitely. And there's this whole thing of tying the pro-animal movement with a more left-wing ideology. So, for instance, talking about veganism as an anti-capitalism movement. Like,
sure.
I mean, the first time I heard that, I was thinking, what? I mean, I'm here for, you know, liberating animals and stopping animal exploitation. Why are we talking about, you know, capitalism and
absolutely,
you know, socialism? And no, this is not what I subscribed for. And there's also this aversion towards religion. I believe that, you know, betting on the religious argument for veganism or for animals is how you connect with people, how you make real lasting change, how you establish this doctrine in the life of people. But there's this aversion, you know, and this perception that you cannot collaborate with religious people to make change. And religion is somewhat responsible for animal exploitation, which, you know, yeah, historically you could make that point, you know, but this is not
like sacrifices, things like that. Is that the argument there, or what's the
well, for instance, you know, anthropocentrism, the fact that, you know, everything is for humans, that we have dominion over everything, and so we can do whatever we want. But I feel like, you know, it doesn't reflect the current reality of, you know, religious discourse. So what do you make of that?
Well, I'll start with the religion one, because that's interesting. I find the dominion argument and that characterization of it really funny, because it's not, that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, if you think about it in a very simplistic sense, like let's say we're, you know, if I have dominion over a people, right? If I have a dominion over some group of people, does that mean that I can then eat my subjects, or I can treat them however I, you know, in whatever cruel and inhumane ways? I mean, that's pretty counter to any doctrinal understanding of leadership or rulership or any to those lines. So I've always found that kind of funny. I actually think by and large, and to the point I think you're making in the beginning of that too, you know, I think it's really working with the faith communities. I think a lot of the, I think when you apply religious values from really any faith to the animal idea, I think that's really where you're going to see a lot of this movement. I think it's really hard, I think, to make a strong religious case for treating animals the way that we do. On the political part of it, and that sort of the anti-capitalist thing, and that whole sense that you alluded to at the beginning of that, that's another interesting one, because I think it's part of the problem too. Why we're not making why the animal movement isn't making the progress that we'd like to see it make is that, you know, there's been a, my opinion is there's the shift on the left where you've had this, I mean, it's always been, you know, traditionally the big government party, the big government idea, but there used to be a almost more anti-establishment sense that I think has kind of gone away, and you sort of leaned into this to, you know, this trust of the government idea, which I think would have been really foreign to a lot of people of the left, you know, a few decades ago or even less. And that's coupled with also, there's been more corporate distrust on the right than maybe even on the left lately, with where you have, you know, Republicans, especially MAGA Republicans, and getting very distrustful of things like big pharma and big, you know, that's kind of the MAHA movement, and big tech in those areas, where I think that's something, if the complaints, the critiques that they're making there really apply to the sort of big ag infrastructure and the ways in which government is really becoming or is one of the at least one of the biggest perpetrators of animal suffering in the world. I mean, when you look at the USDA and the ways in which it bolsters big ag, bolsters industrial meat production, things like, you know, the Bureau of Land Management and the horse roundups and the or wildlife services and the kind of rampant killing of animals out there. I know I'm kind of rattling through things that we could talk about any even more in depth if you'd like, but it's interesting. I think because we're applying these political paradigms to it, and because the left when you have those things like that, making this an anti-capitalist movement or that kind of deal, I think you're kind of allowing for the government to continue to grow and inflict this harm on animals, and you're sort of giving them a free pass to do it.
Let me get back quickly to that outstanding news of, you know, this ban on animal experimentation. I want to just highlight how incredible and impactful this decision from the Trump administration is. You know, he has, you know, liberated millions of sentient creatures from the worst kind of suffering out there, from the worst kind of animal exploitation. And I feel like if this was coming from a left-wing government, if this was the result of some, you know, PETA campaign or your traditional animal rights strain or organization, we would have been witnessing, you know, week after week of celebration, you know, on social media, awards, speeches, like the that accomplishment would have been, you know, celebrated for months. Yet this has been under the radar of most vegans. This went under the radar of most, you know, people who care about animals, as if it was something minor. And the few, you know, animal rights activists I've seen celebrating this accomplishment from the Trump administration always do it, you know, with a few comments on, hey, this is great and they're doing a good job, but I'm against their immigration policy and I'm against this and that, and I think Trump is really, you know, an evil, and which makes everything confusing. Like, how is he responsible of this great accomplishment when he's so evil? Like, what are you talking about exactly? But it's a way to protect themselves against, you know, any perception of being right-leaning for celebrating this progress. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, and again, I think you're I think there's, it's definitely a symptom of sort of the situation we found ourselves in with the kind of the two-party system and this whole deal where you're sort of afraid to step out of the the demagoguery that you're attached to, right? You're absolutely right. If this was the Biden administration and they were, you know, ending animal experimentation in you know, multiple very, you know, extremely large departments within the executive branch, if they were, you know, if Biden was taking that kind of action, it would have been lauded. You'd be hearing about it all over the through all the vegan organizations and all the animal movement podcasts and everything else. And I don't think you really are. Where you are hearing about it, interestingly enough, is through the right wing media outlets, right? Like there's your Fox News, your Daily Callers, your Washington Examiners, Washington Times, all those kinds of outlets are talking about these issues because of the framing and because of the people attached to it. Now, there's some of course, like they have their biases, and that's part of why they're able to talk about these things in such a complimentary way. And who knows how they would be responding to it, if the inverse was true, right? If it was Biden had done this, but I think you're right to point that out, and I appreciate that you do. It's interesting. I really don't think you can point to, and this gets to what you're saying about how big it really is. I don't think you can point to another success in the animal movement right now that is really comparable to what's going on there. I think it's really the biggest strides we've made in any area has probably been there. And you're only really hearing about it in conservative circles. So what does that tell you?
Yeah, I feel like I'm in a parallel universe of this is great. But,
yeah, but I mean, I think it makes the case, right? That again, we're just because people voted for Trump doesn't mean we're some kind of abhorrent monsters that are out for evil. It's just a different, we have different. It's this novel concept that we have different views, and that's okay, But yeah, I think it's very interesting, and I'm interested to see, so really the work that we're doing with the Wilberforce Institute is really trying to make that movement show that concern for animals exists on the right, because I really believe it does already, and coalesce that into a movement that is tangible and that we can really you can point to, so that this is not a couple years down the road when we're talking about these kinds of things again. It's not so unfathomable to anybody the right is spearheading X animal issue.
Yeah, when I learned about your organization, I was so happy. You don't even know. I mean, I felt like being alone, commenting on this issue, this perceived issue, and. I kept thinking, if only there was a more right-leaning or at least nonpartisan organization that is interested and has the ambition of mobilizing everyone on the political spectrum to make changes, lasting changes, and who are not scared to talk to conservatives, and to learn that you have created that organization, you know, just made me so happy. Yeah. So yeah, thank you for that. And
thank you.
And you know, it's is this, should we perceive it, you know, the you talked about this being the greatest success of the pro-animal movement. I agree with that. But does it mean that this animal rights movement right now in this incarnation is dysfunctional, really? Is this, you know, is this success a sign that it has failed at the task of advancing, you know, the animal interests? And you know, I look at, before this conversation, I looked at some coverage of, you know, political situation regarding animal rights. And what was highlighted was bans from different U.S. states on lab-grown meat, or as they like to call it, cultivated meat or clean meat. And, you know, they were picking on that, talking about how conservative states are so evil for banning this industry. And I feel like you're missing the point. You're, what are you doing? Like, trying to advance the interest of corporations that want to play Dr. Frankenstein.
So I don't think that the movement has failed, but I think it needs to evolve, and I think it needs to start shifting its perspective. And I think one of the major ways for one of the main things for that is you know, it's not that every organization needs to start adopting conservative messaging or become you know, conservative organizations or appeal to conservatives, but what they should do is, as groups like, you know, like the Wilberforce Institute come up, and groups like White Coat Waste that already exist, and these other organizations that are good at talking to the right and are involved with the political right, you know, I think they need to understand that, you know, when we're mission aligned on the cause for ending animal suffering, we are allies. We're not, you know, opponents. We're not, you know, and we, you know, you shouldn't be couching, you know, your partnerships with us and that kind of thing. I think when you look at, you know, if you look at the left, this actually kind of goes to some of those comments you read off, right? You can tell in the tone of some of them, there's this, I think there's this idea where maybe the left, maybe the Democratic Party, maybe your average Democrat voter is more generally sympathetic to the animal movement, right? Because they understand that the animal movement is, generally speaking, associated with the left. But they're always going, they always look at it, I think there's a perception at least, that they always look at it as secondary issues, or like, yeah, we'll deal with your issues when we get to it. And, you know, these whatever social justice warrior issues are the front, are the, you know, the primary issues, and these are the ones we need to focus on. Whereas we're over here working on animal issues, and we're, you know, directly involved in actually trying to move the ball forward for animals. Like, those are your allies on these. It's not these other groups that are dismissive of the issues that you care about. I you know, and we're able to talk about these things in ways that I think that would be disingenuous coming from a lot of the groups on the left. You brought up the cultivated meat bans, which I'm actually I wasn't sure if you had the Frankenstein comments there, and I'm actually and I think everybody at Wilberforce is for cultivated meat and moving that technology forward, and we're but you know, when we talk about these bans, I mean, we're able to talk about this from a free market perspective, which is where we've always existed, where we've always, yeah, you know, how we talk about just about every issue. You know, it's kind of, to your point, it's disingenuous for the, you know, these groups to come around and say they oppose these bans, and then they're also anti-capitalist organizations, right? Like, the biggest argument for to oppose these bans is that, you know, if you let the, you know, if you allow for the free market, if you allow for people to, you know, consumers to make their choices, then you're not banning these choices. You're not banning my option as a consumer to try, you know, a new product that, you know, is a cruelty free version of meat, right? That's simply just a free market argument. And so I think it's actually a good argument for why it's important to have our kinds of voices here, is because we're the ones that can make that case, you know?
Yeah, I'm not against, you know, cultivated meat in the sense that if it was available, I would definitely try it and purchase, yeah, and add it to my consumption. But what I don't like is to see, you know, this movement, this social movement, sending all of its money, resources to this industry. You know, it's like, okay, you're a corporation, you want to offer cultivated meat. Well, do it. I mean, why, you know, put the clothes of, you know, a social movement, or, you know, just you want to make profits and you want to offer a new product. Like, of course, it's ethical and it's good to think about, you know, the ethics of, you know, doing business. But you're not like a social movement. You're not an activist movement. You're not part of that. I think that if you look at most successful social movements, they were movements that were driven by religious convictions. That's one point. That were popular movements, non-partisan movements. I think those are traits that, you know, they all share. They were not weird movements that, you know, defended an industry or shilled for corporations or you know, investors. Like, it's weird. Like, I don't have money invested in this venture, so why should I be, you know, promoting it? Yeah.
So that's interesting. That's an interesting perspective. I think of it, it's similar to, well, in some ways, it's the whole opposition to it is like that, where you have an industry that people, you know, I would say the big meat industry has done a really good job of painting themselves as like farmers, right? As this is the pro farming thing, and so they've made it almost a moral stance to support them. When what you're talking about is not farmers, even small meat farmers, as traditionally understood, right? It's not, you're talking about something entirely different. And I do think you see more of that. But it is interesting, an interesting thing to see on the left in general. This sort of movement towards corporations and the kind of the sort of pro corporate stuff that's coming out. I don't know if you heard from one of your countrymen, Neil Young's new song with the. Did you hear any of this? He has this song where it's singing to Ford and GM, you know, and it's a really corny song. Has some kind of dig in there about if you're a fascist, buy a Tesla. Like it's you know, but I was thinking it's the, who would have thought, you know, to like think it, comparing him to Neil Young of the 60s and 70s. It's a wild thing to see that. I think sometimes that's a lot of, again, where I think the importance of getting sort of the perspective we're bringing to this involved is that we're really there's been this kind of corporate movement that I think is actually hurts the animal movement for the left to have kind of bought into that, you know, and I think being, you know, giving an alternative to that is something that's going to help move things forward as well too. We're not, you know, it's ultimately special interests that drive a lot of these conversations, and that's the kind of thing we need to get away from for sure.
Yeah, and I value consistency. You know, if you are anti-capitalist and you oppose cultivated meat, like, I value that. You're consistent. So at the very least, you're not a hypocrite, you know, in your thinking. So, there is that. Okay, moving forward. Do you know of any new progress, new policies that the Trump administration will put in place that would benefit animals. The latest one was about the Navy. So now we're talking about the military renouncing, you know, animal experimentations. So are you aware of any more, you know, progress?
So interesting, you brought up the military one. I have an article I'm pushing out right now to try to get published. It's on moving to the Army and getting the Army to do the same thing the Navy did, and kind of taking this go Army beat Navy type stance, which I was in the Army myself. So it's, you know, it's a sort of point of pride to me that I don't want them to be the last ones through the door on that. You know, I don't know where there's a number of bills that we're hoping that move forward. A lot of them deal with, you know, animal experimentation. Yeah, hopefully that continues throughout the administration and throughout the executive branch. When we start seeing more and more of these departments that are, because there still are departments that are conducting research. There's some of the ones that are still that are you know, that have kind of signed up to stop it, that are still doing it in other ways, or they're, you know, so there's a lot more work to do there. And I think that obviously there's an appetite to do it. There's, you know, I'd like to see that expanded into some things like, you know, the USDA has the Agriculture Research Services, which is sort of the research arm for, it's effectively the de facto research department of the big industrial farmers, right? And so they're conducting cruel experiments, and they're doing so solely to make the big factory farms produce more, right? And it's not produce better. It's not improve animal welfare conditions. It's not improve the food quality. It's solely to just crank out more. You know, there's a free market argument where it's, you know, we'll let them do it. Fine, let's say we're doing that, but why are we paying for it? Why would our tax dollars go to, you know, funding this department? Why can't the biggest of these companies handle their own research? Why would we be doing, you know? So it doesn't really make sense from a free market level. Or, you know, from just a taxpayer perspective at all, it's just, you know, rampant cronyism. So I'd like to see them kind of get there. I'd like to kind of, I'd hope that Brooke Rollins, who is the ag secretary, can kind of, you know, pick up on these wins and maybe move that direction as well. Outside of that, I know there's a lot that I'd like to see happen. I'm not sure where it's going to go.
What about the subsidies? You know, the big ag subsidies. Do you think we'll see some of them being, you know, reduced or abolished?
I hope so. And that would be, you mentioned before, value and consistency, and that would be the consistent approach. I actually, I don't know if you followed at all the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and the whole debate that's ensuing there. It's another article I have out for placement right now on that, and how, you know, there's the debate to be had for sure, even within conservative libertarian circles, about the wisdom of putting a bunch of money, you know, raising the allotments and spending for the border and the military and that kind of thing. I mean, there's different approaches. But, you know, that in that 1,000+ page bill, there's, you know, plenty of those pages that are just filled up with what I would call factory farm welfare. And it's, I mean, it's really, it's big ag subsidies. It's, you know, these insurance kind of bailout policies that they've created too. So it's like, there's one in there, one provision that's for, you know, theoretical unborn cows that aren't born, that they pay, that, you know, make them indemnity payments for that. And it's, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff. And it represents billions of dollars. I think that, you know, if we're talking about this, we're taking kind of the Rand Paul approach to this, where he said, hey, look, I'm for these cuts, but the spending is just unacceptable, you know, and raising the ceiling to $5 trillion is crazy, right? Well, one way where the case I make in the article, and what I would say in general is, you know, why don't we look at this area as one of the places where we can start reducing that gigantic price tag that's associated with this bill? So I haven't heard much about, it hasn't seemed to be a top line issue, which is another one of those, the magic tricks of the big ag special interest. But I would like to see, I think draining the big ag swamp is something that is very congruent with libertarian thought, with MAGA thought, and it's something that I hope that we can move that direction and start making some real strides there, because it's just crazy. And it's the way, it's a lot of what I'm talking about when I say it. You know, it's really our government that is bolstering the factory farming world.
It's strange because I think 1 year ago I was having a conversation with Robert Grillo, and he's big into protesting big ag lobby and, you know, infiltrating their meetings and all of that. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how, you know, animal rights organizations or you know, vegans supporting animal welfare laws was not that, you know, impactful, and that the real impact was would be to get rid of those subsidies, get rid of that money. And
yeah,
and I'm so happy to see that this is now part of the conversation. You know, at the time when I was discussing this with Robert, I think there wasn't any mention of that on the news or in political debates and all of that. But I feel like Trump has brought this on the table.
Yeah, and I think Trump, you know, so one of the things Trump talked about when he was running for office was the revolving door from the lobbyists to bureaucrats, back to lobbyists, back to bureaucrats. And that's, you know, that's really kind of what he's defined as that swamp. Right. And I think when you know, and you look at people like RFK, who, you know, when he was, before he jumped on board the Trump campaign, he was in his own campaign, he was talking a lot about that kind of thing and the cronyism, you know, that was a big focus for him. Same with like a Tulsi Gabbard, who, you know, who we'll talk about the deep state all the time. I think that right there, like, so, you know, because I get into this a good amount with people in the animal movement when they're trying to understand what we're working on with Wilberforce. I, you know, people always want to talk about regulations and bans and that kind of thing. And it's, you know, it's not that I'm against regulations altogether, but when you create this structure where you have this entrenched executive branch that's filled with people who are industry lobbyists. I brought up Tom Vilsack earlier, but I think Vilsack, for the last, you know, he's a great example because for the last decade, he's had two jobs. One of them is head of ag, and he did that for Biden and for Obama. And when he's not doing that, he's a big dairy lobbyist. I mean, whose interests do we think he's working for when he's in that position? You know, when that's his other job, that's the job he's going to go back to, and that's where he makes his real money, right? And I mean, you have that. That's a big example, but you have that all throughout these branches. So when you're talking about these regulations and the ways in which, you know, there's a problem I think Congress has where they'll write these 1,000-page bills, and these bills are count out to a number of special interests, but they also defer a whole lot of their legislative power over to these executive branches. And so you send it over to these unelected bureaucrats who come from the industries that they're supposed to regulate, and they write regulations. And when I say I'm against those regulations, I'm the person who's I'll get criticized for that, saying I'm not for the animals. Well, the people who are hurting the animals are writing those regulations effectively, right? And so I think, yeah, a lot of it, I think that's right to say that the subsidies are a big part of this, because a lot of what we're doing is just kind of is putting the people who are already, you know, these massive industrial meat producers, these massive factory farms, or, you know, these gigantic corporations, they have, you know, a ton of unaccountable interests in the government, and can guide the way these regulations are made. So I think a bigger thing is, like, let's stop funding them. Let's stop bolstering it. Let's stop, you know, creating an environment where they're, you know, where we're not just, you know, not regulating, we're actually enhancing the cruelty and the waste and everything else.
Do you feel like you're having a fight on both fronts with the animal rights movement trying to gain acceptance and support and, you know, tolerance, and also against, you know, those lobbyists, this industry, and the corruption and the animal exploitation?
Yes and no. I'll say, on the one side, yes. I mean, we have these big, powerful interests that I think are on both sides. And, you know, we had, I mean, the first day we launched, I think it's just because some of the conservative names attached to us have been in the space and have already drawn that ire from these guys. But the first day we launched, we had a attack ad that was pretty clearly coming from not an ad, but a blog that was guessing at what we were and going attacking us from the start. So that stuff's there. You know, we've talked about some of the hostility and the that comes from within the animal movement. But I'll say also, on the other end of it. So we've done now, the beginning of the year, we did a Students for Liberty event called LibertyCon. It's a big libertarian event, very student driven. And some of that was a temperature shaking, right? It was our first time, we'd done a whole bunch of articles and things, but we hadn't really been out on the ground yet. I mean, we only launched back in September, So, and when we did it, we had no pushback, there was no one angrily yelling at us or, making, any of the kinds of things you'd worry there would be. There's, I can't say everybody in the, at the conference all signed up, but a ton did. We had a bunch of people come talk to us. They were very enthusiastic about it. A lot of them said what you said, which is something I've heard even before launching, is something I thought myself was kind of the impetus for starting it, which is, man, I wish something like this had existed for years. There's always kind of needed something like this to exist. And so, it was super positive. And then on the flip side of it too, I went and did, this is where you and I met, a panel at, AVA, Animal Vegan Advocacy
yes.
Summit. Is that right?
Yes.
There you go. It's always easier to say AVA, but I went and did the panel there. Same kind of thing. It was a temperature shaking the other way, right? Like, how are we going to be perceived? Is we're this conservative libertarian organization where, we have the opinions that we do. And I was worried there's going to be a ton of blowback. I got none. It was actually, I think there's a whole lot of interest in people who from people who are thinking like, man, you know what? It's probably a bad idea that we've been in a silo, that we've been cutting off the side, because now the side has taken over the whole of American government. And if we want to move the needle, we need to figure out how. And so there's a ton of people who wanted to talk to us and were interested in talking to us from that perspective. So honestly, I think it's been, I think part of like why I get the privilege of doing this is that I wasn't really too worried about making enemies. And I like making friends, but I ultimately have enough of them. I don't need to change what I think to appease anybody. And I'm not worried about, that kind of thing. So, But on the other hand, it's been a really positive experience. I think a lot of people get what we're doing and really support the idea. I think there's a lot of conservatives and libertarians out there who have just, who really have wanted a kind of ideological home, a place to kind of point to say like, no, I'm this kind of person. This is what I think about animals, and here's how it coalesces with what I think and my values. And it's a really cool thing to be able to kind of represent that and to build that.
Yes, the event, this is where we met, and I wish I attended your panel, but I could not. But I did attend a meetup you organized. It was called something like conservative, libertarian, classical liberal meetup, something like that. And it was so funny because there was just a handful of people, and everyone, when we introduced ourselves, no one was conservative.
Yeah. I made a joke about that in my panel. I said, I was like, we had a tremendous response, way more than I anticipated. It was five strong. And of that group, it was, I think there was like three people who were, curious, independents. You had, it was like, no one that showed up was like a card carrying, MAGA Republican, there's one like kind of quasi libertarian. That was sort of the point in and of itself. Right. I do think, go ahead. But I was glad you came there. I'm glad that is where we met. And it was it's funny. I mean, what I talked about in the panel with that was, you know, that you had over 1,000 people probably at AVA, and of them, there's what, you know, maybe 3 Trump voters. You know, I mean, you know, that's probably not surprising to people, but the case I made to them is I think it should be surprising, and it's something that, you know, like, look, there's part of this where, you know, conservatives and libertarians, we need to take some ownership and get, you know, take some active, you know, like kind of force our way into the movement a little bit, right? Like, we need to take some ownership of the causes that we care about. But on the other hand, it's, you know, the challenge I threw to the people at the panel was, you know, are you doing what you can? Are you being intentional about expanding this movement, expanding the intellectual diversity here? Because, you know, there really should be a larger representation than that, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. There's a real bias, you know, first of all, there's gatekeeping. Mm-hmm. If you announce that you're a conservative, you won't get support, like community support from fellow vegans. Mm-hmm. And then there's an intentional, you know, desire not to reach out to conservatives, like this defeatist attitude of thinking, oh, but they're conservatives, they won't care about animals.
Yeah.
And then they complain that conservatives are not more, you know, caring about animals. You know, you haven't in the last, you know, decades, what kind of actions have you done targeted to conservatives? Zero. The answer is zero. Sure. So if you look at, you know, the landscape of, you know, who is vegan and who isn't, and you see that most conservatives are not vegan, maybe you have a responsibility in that. Maybe you're to blame for
sure. Yeah. And I would point out most liberals aren't vegan either, you know. But it's I know the numbers are different, but still. But you know, you had 2 conservative vegans on at one point. I listened to that show. It was a very good episode. And one of the guests had mentioned that she was in a Facebook group of conservative vegans that was like 1,500 people, you know. And this is another thing I talked about in the in my panel was I'm in a, you know, Wilberforce, we're in an X group, right? A direct message group on X that's, I mean, you know, pretty substantial, it's pretty large, and it's you know, it's called the Patriot Animal Network, and it's a bunch of people who are probably mostly very, you know, pro-Trump MAGA Republicans, some libertarians in there, but very, very conservative crowd, right? And most of them have some kind of involvement in animal welfare. A lot of them do it professionally. Some of them are just like social media influencers who do, who do a lot of animal oriented posts. And you know, we have this group going, this network, and it's, but you know, oh, the other thing with them, what surprised me with that group too, cause I did a kind of an ad hoc poll, cause I was curious. Cause it's not something that's very talked about very much in that group, but as it turns out, probably most of them are vegan, or if not most of them, it's close to the majority of them. I mean, most of the people that responded certainly were. And so I you know, my question is, why aren't they going to things like AVA, right? Why aren't they involved in these kinds of movements? So, you know, and like I said, part of that's on us, on the conservatives and libertarians. And I'm going to do my part to try to push them out to these events and get them to kind of take that ownership. But yeah, it's, you know, these people, they exist, they are there, they're real, you know, and I mean, you know, it only helps the movement for us to get to kind of coalesce and start working on these animal causes together, for sure.
I was scared at the election because I was thinking, now that conservatives have taken over, there won't be any pro-animal vegan voice at the table. And so we have stopped ourselves from making any progress because we have uninvited ourselves from, you know, the conservative center of powers. But I was wrong. In fact, I was very wrong. Because the biggest...
I was waiting to tell you, but you already know. Go ahead.
But, you know, my other fear around that was that I look at the Democratic Party and I look at what constitutes the liberal bloc, voter bloc, and I'm thinking those people will not gain back power for years to come. Like, they're so disconnected from reality and from, you know, the mainstream normal person in the streets that, you know, I'm not very optimistic about their political prospects. And I guess, you know, I'm looking at the midterm election to see if the Republicans will keep the House, because I guess that would be a great indicator of the political future of the Democratic Party. But, you know, then, so if we uninvited ourselves from, you know, the center of power, the conservative center of powers, and we're not there to advocate for animals, and conservatives will have power for years and years to come, then we, you know, virtually have shoot ourselves in the foot, you know, in terms of progress and advancing the animal cause. Now, I was wrong, but, you know, what do you make of that analysis?
That's interesting. I don't know if I'm the best, political forecaster. I'm as interested as you are to see kind of what the midterms, you know, hold and what that ends up looking like. I do agree. I think that there's that sort of, you know, the Democratic Party definitely has a problem with being massively out of touch. I think, I don't want to upset the listeners too much, but you know, I would recommend to them, letting their voters pick their own candidates would be a good start. I don't know if they've had a real if they've actually really had a primary election for president in like 12 years, but I think it's interesting. I think that now, because of the work of groups like White Coat Waste, and because of the willingness of a lot of the, we've done a lot of joking and teasing of the animal movement on this discussion, and also some, you know, some I think realistic and worthwhile criticisms, right? But I mean, there are a lot of very smart and very intentional and very good people in the animal movement that are also very pragmatic and are seeing this issue and understanding that, you know, the left has this problem, and they're working on, you know, in very sincere and genuine ways, like, okay, how do we fix this? How do we extend these olive branches? How do we improve this situation? And I think that work is going to matter. I think this, you know, if you're right, if your assessment's right, and the Democrats aren't, going to get anything together anytime soon, and we're looking at them dealing with a lot of electoral losses for a while, which I think is a reasonable assessment for sure. Then I think that we should look at that as an opportunity to build up, you know, the animal movement in the political right. And happy to talk to anyone who wants to talk about how we do that.
Yeah, you're very optimistic. Do you believe that there is a way forward? In terms of bipartisanship in the animal rights movement, or do you see divisions in the future? You know, those pragmatic and smart people, and I hope I'm one of them.
You are.
Thank you. Separating themselves from the mainstream animal rights movement, and, you know, just following other, because I asked the same question to Rabbi Akiva in a previous episode, and I mentioned, you know, do you see a future where Jews, vegan Jews, would come back to the animal rights, you know, movement fold? And he said, no, I don't see that. I think we're going to do our own thing. Makes me feel a bit sad, but at the same time, I think there is more place for diversity then, of opinion and thoughts, for this movement. And maybe, you know, this united approach is less impactful than maybe a more divisive one, and everyone doing their own thing. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's an interesting question. I think that there's a lot of, so I guess part of this is informed by, you know, I you probably noticed I always refer to Wilberforce as conservative and libertarian, right? And we have conservatives and libertarians, and that is as close to a catch-all for the big tent that we're operating under here that I can get, right? It was you mentioned the meetup that we did, and I literally called it a conservative libertarian meetup. But then it was like, I don't care, you know, it's like you call yourself a classical liberal, ANCAP, like I put every single designator that I could think of, you know, because I wanted to say, like, as widely defined as we can, you know, that's who we're looking for here, right? And so I think there's something similar to that within the animal movement. I guess I kind of see it in the same way, where it's like there's a general cause, there's a general purpose, a general mission, and then a bunch of different approaches to it in a bunch of different ways. And I think, you know, I think that can coalesce very broadly and then work, you know, intentionally very in different channels, right? And sometimes, you know, and collaborating where that makes sense too. I think there's a magazine called The American Conservative, right? And that magazine came out during the Bush years, and it was actually a reaction to the Bush presidency, right? And it was very anti-immigration. It was very, you know, border security. It was very anti-war, and the number of these issues that at the time, you know, they did it again to kind of protest Bush and call themselves the American Conservative, right? And it was very different than what the Republican Party looked like at the time. But you look at the Republican Party now, and what they started writing about then is basically the Republican Party now, right? It is the Trump era Republican. It looks exactly like what they were talking about, you know. And these are actually the guys, incidentally, who put J.D. Vance on the map. They reviewed his book, Hillbilly Elegy, and that's what started the rise of that book and made it a bestseller and all of that. So I'm not saying that the American Conservative magazine is the reason that we have now, you know, the Republican Party that we do, but definitely they were early in shaping that thought, and they were working in those channels to shape that thought. I think about them when I feel like this is like a very uphill battle, because I realize what we're trying to do really is create a meaningful segment of the American political right that cares about animals, right, and that is working intentionally for animals, and make that, you know, we would love to see it be a real serious, you know, plank of the Republican Party and that kind of thing. That seems a lot more attainable when I start thinking about what, you know, the way in which that party shifted. So I think that you can use that example, and you kind of, if you think about the way this movement's going to grow and shape, and the way these paradigms can shift over, you know, in not that long of a time, I think it, you know, I guess that's where my optimism comes from on it.
Wonderful. I think those are great words to close the conversation. Liam, did you want to add something before I stop the recording?
No, I think I covered just about everything. I think it was a great conversation. I appreciate you taking the time to do it. I would love, you know, anyone who wants to find out more about what we're doing, check us out at Wilberforce.institute, or go to see us on X. It's at WilberforceInst. Also, happy to continue the conversation with anybody if they want to try to send us an email.
Yes, and you know, I will mention all of that in the introduction, and of course there will be links in the episode notes for easy access to all of that.
Oh, okay.
Wonderful.
Well, you can cut that part out. That's fine.
It's okay. I mean, I'll do some editing, you know, just to have a better flow. Mostly editing my questions, you know.
I thought your questions were great.
yes, but you know, the execution.
No, it was perfect. I think you did better. You executed better than I did, for sure.
No. Your answers were great. Thank you so much, Liam, for having accepted my invitation and answered my questions. And thank you so much for your precious work. I'm again so happy that you exist.
thank you. Thank you for yours. And I'm excited. I'm glad to call you a friend. I'm excited to talk more to you. And yeah, let's keep our conversations going.
Definitely. I consider you as a friend too. Thank you everyone for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.